as you know, as I've told you in emails, I've been reading a lot of Ken Wilber, and what I've noticed, and I did send you this as a bullet point, is the whole issue of competition. Now, in sport, competition is the central motif, and because, you know, the game starts, the game ends, there's a winner, there's a loser, and to move, and it's an old Timothy Leary phrase, to move from the payoff to the playoff, in other words, to get into the experience, which in some sense the Millman film alluded to that. You know, don't worry about the score, get into the experience and the score will take care of itself.
Right.
And I think every athlete who plays, when you really get into that, that's where you want to be.
Right.
You know, but what's driven you in the process has been a very competitive one, and in the NFL, and to play in the NFL is extremely competitive and extremely selective.
Right.
And that is a, you know, a primary driver. And maybe it's one reason why, because spiritual training has been seen as non-competitive.
Yes.
So it's been seen as the opposite of sport, because sport is so competitive.
Right.
And so it is seen to be incompatible, when in fact it is really not that incompatible, if I believe this is what both of us are saying.
Well, exactly. And certainly on the state side of the street, and that's where, in terms of actual states of consciousness, the witnessing state and the non-dual flow state are essentially identical, with very, very profound states of samadhi and states of oneness, where subject and object become one. And there's actually a whole exploration in sports of that state that in its own way is more profound than what you find in spiritual texts. And spiritual texts essentially look at the mind when it is in stillness, when it is, in a sense, not moving, when it's quiet.
Right.
And so it doesn't notice meta-normal things from this non-dual flow state that you do notice if you're playing baseball, for example.
Yes.
And you get in a flow state in baseball when somebody's pitching the ball, and you can count the stitches on the ball when it comes in. It's unbelievable.
Or the basket is, 8 feet in diameter. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And you're dropping the ball into the basket as you're shooting up. These kinds of things are an exploration, as Mike Murphy has well defended this notion, but it's an exploration of the meta-normal capacities of human consciousness.
Exactly.
And so what happens is that extraordinarily profound state comes out and is often immediately grabbed up by a red or egocentric or power structure, and because that's what the actual context is. That's where the lower left is in maybe the team sport, is just that winning.
Well,
winning.
But you can certainly see where, to use your phrase, the red dovetails with competition very easily.
Well, exactly, and that's why I'm bringing it up.
And when you move up to teamwork, that's, yes, well, but you're now one team competing against another team. But,
exactly.
But I think the observation is, too, is that in order to enter these states, if you will, or to access these states, you know, I've said in the past, sometimes, you know, you should love your opponent more than your teammate, because without your teammate, you couldn't move into these states. You wouldn't have a context of play to be able to move, or to be able to experience, I should say, not move. But I think, again, if you would give a point to competition, because, you know, it's ubiquitous in the culture.
Right.
You know, we are a capitalist, competitive, market-driven economy, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the one reason why we have the, our particular sport theater being NFL football, which it is look at the nature of the game and what goes on in the game.
Right.
And extremely competitive. It's defense and conquest of territory through violence. As the old coach said, in football, you got to hit somebody. You know?
Right.
And so that's our, you know, and we got the big games coming up on Sunday. So,
Well, that's exactly. Let me go ahead and actually read the bullet point about that. Where does competition fit in spiritual practice? Is it something to be transcended? In my experience, it does. It seems to me that in consciousness literature, competition is never mentioned, the elephant in the living room. It is central to sport and a powerful energy that drives sport and athletes at one level of the experience and is transcended at another level. in sport, winning as an essential part and measure within the athletic experience in sport. Competition is a powerful driver in the society. Where does it fit in? And I think you really got it exactly right when you say that it is a powerful energy that drives sport and athletes at one level of experience and is transcended at another level.
Yes.
And I think that's exactly right. And I think it happens in sort of two senses. One is, again, whenever you're plunged into these states, it's a self-transcendence. And then when you come out, if your structure is red, you're going to interpret that in an egocentric, red, power-driven, winning,
yeah, right,
competitive fashion.
Beating your chest, yes, yes.
Exactly, thump,
right,
thump, thump, me
right,
Tarzan.
Right.
And often then the conflict occurs with the only contextualization it's given is that you should want the team to win, not you. And so you might coach say, no, it's the team. You're going out there playing for the team, not playing for yourself. They have trouble with mavericks and prima donnas who won't fit in well with team play.
To the rules, yes.
Exactly. So there's a lot of the pressures between red and amber, between egocentric and ethnocentric, or between self-powered and team-powered. But there are a fair number of athletes, and there are an increasing number of athletes, that are at modern to postmodern and even integral, and that are at pluralistic and are driving towards a postmodern.
No, that's true. No, I know that to be true.
And that's self-actualization.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, that's the actual structure of their interpretations for self-actualization. So it's down at the early stages of needs to express this in Maslow's levels of needs, which are essentially the same way of stating these levels of structures we've been talking about.
Right.
And they go from physiological and basically self-protective and self-promoting, which is the red or egocentric or power drive, and then they go to belongingness or conformist or amber or team-driven, ethnocentric-driven, and then to self-esteem, which is a orange winning is part of this, but it's based on driving one's own self-esteem and one's view of one's own self, and then into self-actualization. And that's where you start to get a real transcendence and a move beyond even self-esteem into finding one's deepest and highest potentials as an artwork.
Yeah, and you know, and one of the interesting things just popped into my mind is even as you see these intense games happen, you know, obviously they're intense, but look what happens after the game. You know, you'll see guys milling around each other, shaking hands, you know, giving each other hugs. I mean, you know, and they're guys they, you know, played with at college or they, you know, went to school with and what have you, or played with on other teams in the NFL. And it's always so interesting to see if people will watch and say, well, what's going on there? Well, it's that whole notion of, look, we all got into this pretty intense, incredible state with each other in this game. It's over, and how we really feel about each other is this.
Right.
And that we honor that and recognize that with each other.
Right.
And it's actually one of the most beautiful things to see in sport, which I've seen in a number of different sports, where athletes post incredible competition have basically just kind of, you know, fallen on each other.
Right.
You know, boxing matches, you see it, where guys just really, really appreciate each other in a profound, transcendental way, you might say. You know?
And so part of what we're sort of looking at here is what kind of context can be set up to basically set sports in a more accurate setting. So it's not just seen as sort of red or maybe a little bit teamwork, but mostly sort of red, competitive power, winning, 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 and see it as a, you know, more self-actualization and self-transcendence and a drive towards those things that actually unite humanity and not those things that divide it.
Right. And I think there are coaches around, particularly on the high school level, who are doing that, who really see that the value is not the winning, it's the value of how they interpret or talk about character building, you know. And, and it's in a weird kind of way, it gets back to the old good sportsmanship kind of thing, you know, like play the game and on, you know, respect the game and respect your opponent and and do those sorts of things, which frankly are higher values.
Exactly.
Than,
yeah, they're all
than,
team, all teamwork.
Than trying to cheat and do all that kind of stuff. But and so it's always been part of sport, and I think the observation that, you know, in this activity there are these range of possibilities of how to look at it and how to teach it and how to experience it. And a lot of what we see, unfortunately, I think, is the pandering to the, if you will, the lower values of the experience,
right,
as opposed to the of really looking at it in terms of what it can be,
right,
what its possibilities are.
And that is, I think, one of the things that happens as you move out of high school. In high school, they can sort of afford
exactly
to do that
because it's still seen as
right.
Yeah, right. An educational kind of thing. But when
right.
you certainly get into the big leagues in college, and it is the big leagues,
right.
the whole thing changes pretty dramatically. I can tell you that. Yeah.
Let's talk just a little bit then about Out of Their League and
okay.
some of the things that you documented at that time in the sports history, and just sort of some of the devastating account, and basically going over so many of the, I guess, brutalities of this sport.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a few.
Oh, I don't know. Yes, the question. it's a funny thing because in some sense, I'm not trying to cop out, but you go through the experience. And it's part of the experience, and you've experienced it, and you've survived it, or whatever.
And that's just it.
And it's just what it is.
Right.
And when you put it in a little different, context, if you will, people say, well, wow, that's really brutal, and that's really
right.
tough. Well,
right.
it happens to be the nature of the game,
right.
and comparing what I did with somebody at the time in Vietnam or these guys over, our guys in Iraq right now, I mean, it doesn't compare in terms of the level of terror and fear and brutality and all the rest of it that people experience. It is a very, very tough game, and if you've looked at the book, I mean, I injured people permanently, and people
yeah.
were trying to injure me, and at the time, which is in one of the things I talked about, people being shot up, you get hurt and you shoot you up, and you
right.
deaden the injury so you can continue playing.
Right.
And now that has become almost routine. I mean,
yeah.
they'll take a guy in a locker room and he comes out running.
Right.
You say, what happened to him? Well, it gave him the needle.
Yeah.
That's what happened to him.
Yeah.
And so there's an aspect of the game, but it is the nature of the game. And I think the issues that rankled me probably more than anything, which I call the dehumanizing aspect, were really how athletes were treated in this system, and that you, as an athlete, this was your craft, this was your art, this was what you did at a very, very high level and very
right.
competitive level, had really no say-so, if you will, about how all this was happening.
Right.
The rules of the game and what was going on. And and from a little social jump to it, I talk about in the book when President Kennedy was murdered,
right,
and how the players didn't want to play the game,
right,
but the league went ahead and did play the
yeah,
game.
Sort of.
In contrast, Ken, and not too many people know this, after 9/11, the league wanted to play the games that weekend, and the players, through a mechanism now, because we have an organization
right.
and could basically get to the commissioner to say the players do not want to play,
right.
cancel the games.
Right.
And that happened.
Right.
So that is just in terms of contrasting two different situations. And my view has always been is the more, you know about what you're doing in terms of it, in all its different dimensions, the better player you're going to be.
Right.
And not to long, a thing I haven't talked to you about, but at a point in my life, I did teach for 4 years to the football players at Stanford University, and we went through a number of these kinds of experiences. And probably shouldn't have dropped that into this conversation, but it really demonstrated to me in terms of, because we did everything in that class from meditation to guided imagery to the athletic
yes.
budget to coach-player relations to why are you here at Stanford as an elite football player.
Right.
And by examining all these aspects of their lives, they actually did play better. And they said so. Their record proved it, and so on and so on. So to
right.
me, it was kind of, as I would tell tell people, this stuff works, and consciousness does work, and
right.
it is just a question of being able to be in a situation where you can teach it.
Right.
And one of my interests, which you know also, is even in gyms now, or where people are just doing athletic training but not training for a sport, so much of this can be taught.
Right.
But you need teachers or coaches or trainers who are educated in it. And certainly Sean Phillips is one of the guys who put together a system, but
right.
It works, you know.
And are you aware of many other places that are teaching this kind of thing?
Not really. I do some of it. My Stanford experience was just a very unique experience.
Right.
To tell you the truth, I think it can. I think people are kind of coming to it in certain ways.
Right.
I think your work at the Integral Institute, you guys do sports and you introduce these kinds of aspects to your work. So, that's maybe the next big chunk we should look at, how that gets out into the world, through this medium of sport,
And let me come back to that and just kind of pick up on when you, if you don't mind, just a little bit of history. And I realize that sort of going back over it can be kind of, a can of worms. But it's just drawing conclusions like you did just now, I think are really good, points and really valid conclusions. And I was just curious about then your experience during the decade or so that you were with the St. Louis Cardinals and what you saw there. And again, some of the brutalities are just described in a third person way. They can sound, extremely torturous, but in fact, it was just the day-to-day life of what guys
exactly.
chose to do.
Yeah.
But some guys continued to almost enjoy doing.
Sure. And it is what it is.
It is what it is.
The saying goes, what you need to do to do it. Yeah.
But it's certainly the case that they didn't have a voice in
no, not at that time. Not at that time. Not at that time we didn't. And it was one of the motivations for me to want to work for the Players Association. And
just what I was going to ask.
And to help, make this transformation, which we did. And, as I like to say, we fought basically an 11-year war with the owners.
Right.
And we won.
Right.
And we were able to change the system and give the players – certainly a lot more say-so with free agency. In the old days, you were assigned a team by the draft, and that was the team you
yeah.
played with, and
yeah.
you could never leave.
Yeah.
And to me, having choice is always a question of a function of increasing consciousness.
I think.
Ultimately,
right.
that's what democracy is about.
Yeah.
And so we basically established that and got that in place for players, and then we were able to do a lot of things in terms of working conditions that protect the players and so that, they're not so vulnerable when they get injured and so on and so
right.
on. So
right.
so that was, when I came out and I wrote the book and then circumstances occurred that I was able to, start working for the Players Association, did that
right.
for 25 years and
right.
and now popped out on the other side. And we basically accomplished what we needed to accomplish.
Yeah.
In a big sense, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, a real congratulations on that. It's a really extraordinary story, and really, kudos for all of that.
Yeah, and it was a struggle. I think people know. I mean, I think we're all in the process of looking at the world and how to make the world better. And a lot of the story is you've got to get in there and go toe to toe sometimes with the forces that don't want to change, and it's either through education or through various leverages, but I believe, we are all in that process, at some level. So
right.
it's just how we're doing our work kind of thing.
Right. So what then led you specifically to work and developing the Esalen Sports Center?
Well, for me, when I was playing, and as I said, in 1968, a long time ago now, I went out to Esalen. And through a friend of mine said, geez, she had been out there. She came back and said, you should go out there. So I went out there. And I was, my mind was blown, so to speak,
right.
in terms of what are these people doing?
Right.
And it was the first time that I started thinking, geez, people can be with each other in a different kind of way and look at
right.
what's happened here. And the idea of self-examination or self-revelation, focusing on that and what that could produce.
Right.
And then I started thinking about that in relation to playing football.
Right.
And I did have some pharmacological help,
right.
and so opened it up a little bit, and started to I think you know, the context thing, and you mentioned it in your writings, Ken, is so important because
right.
you don't have the language and you don't have the context.
Right.
You know, you use the wolf kid, you know, example.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
But if you don't have it, you can't express it, doesn't develop. And that's why your four quadrant model, I think, is so excellent. And so, you know, it was a process of also being involved with the political activities and now in consciousness activities. And I started reading Ram Dass's stuff and Krishnamurti and so on and starting to open up in terms of that. And, of course, I was playing football and I thought, well, how does this relate to sport?
Right.
You know, and I went out to Esalen and they weren't talking about sport. It was kind of this mind-body schism was still in effect.
Right.
And then when I quit and I connected with Mike Murphy and I said, Mike, what's going on with this? I've been there. And that's when we started talking about, well, where does consciousness fit, consciousness training, if you will, to use that phrase,
right.
fit in with sport? How does it fit in with what Esalen's doing? And that's when we decided to, and they, of course, you know, made the investment and the institutional investment to put together the sports center.
Right.
And that's kind of how it happened. But a lot of it came from my own experience, and I think I've always said you scratch an athlete and you give him some language, you know, some context
yeah.
language to talk about it.
Yeah,
he'll say you start, you'll get some amazing stories, you know, and
true,
and it is so true. And Murphy and Rhea White's book, The Zone,
right.
is a compendium of those stories,
right?
And so it's kind of there, but it's never really talked about. And of course, even the there's a famous story of Michael Jordan hitting his 6-3 and comes down the floor and he just kind of shrugs his shoulders and with
yeah.
his grin on his face. And everybody knows, his guys know what he's talking about. Like, I'm in it, man.
Right.
I can't miss. You know? so, you know, so it's
if
this kind of unspoken stuff that is going on there.
Well, okay, right there, the unspoken
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
And that comes back to your point about the lower left quadrant not having a language and therefore the upper left quadrant not really having a chance to sometimes even experience it, or let alone when they experience it, know how to talk about it. And
well, that's why we say it's the zone. You know, it's the zone is the catch-all for everything. You know?
Exactly.
What does it mean? You know, it's just,
and which it's, makes me, you know, sort of wonder what other terminology, you know, is out there, could we come up with that would, in a sense, contextualize the spiritual component of what
right.
athletes are doing, because they are getting into these states, no matter what structure they interpret it with, they are getting into these states.
Exactly.
Consciously.
Yes.
And
yes.
there is this training, and that's another bullet point that I'll go ahead and read. Many similarities exist between an explicit spiritual practice and athletic practice or training. Repetition, focus, regularity, I'd add intentionality, concentration, etc.
Mm-hmm.
In the former, the community of the adequate, that is to say the contemplative community, measures validity, truth, and development, as you point out. And then in the latter, objective performance measures development or success, winning, losing, transcending personal limits, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But there is indeed these extraordinary, not just general similarities, but actual techniques of mind training that are identical in
right.
spirit.
Right, I think so. And I, you know, we could do that, you know, at some point or even block that out. Because,
right.
And what I didn't say in that phrase, too, in looking this over, what I wrote, is that this does not measure the personal, what is going on subjectively with the individual athlete
exactly.
in this winning, losing, so on and so on and so on, which is, as I've said before, I think in individual sports, it's a little more acute. And when you look at Murphy's work and the Rhea White book, it happens a lot in individual sports.
Right.
That there is, you know, the maybe that little more introspective focus or that
right.
experience, and then trying to explain what happens,
right.
it's a little easier to do.
There's a shift in motivation between first and second tier, and according to Abe Maslow, who is the first to actually really study one of the major shifts that occurs in development,
right.
and that is at all of these structures we talked about, all of the early ones are called first tier, and they're called first tier because they're marked, each of them is marked by the belief that their values are the only essentially correct values around.
Correct, exactly.
So fundamentalists believe that only their truth is true.
Scientists, and if you don't believe like I believe.
That's right. Scientists believe that only science is right.
The right, right.
Postmodernists believe that only postmodernism is right. And what Maslow called an extraordinary leap of meaning, a momentous leap of meaning, beginning in second tier, the stage there intuitively understands that all of those previous stages are needed, that there's room for them. And so they tend to meet people where they are. They tend to have at least an intuitive understanding of these different stages and tend to not get really combative or argumentative over worldviews, except to be very inclusive and to make room for everybody, and that everybody's right.
In the best of all possible worlds, yes.
In the best of all possible ways, exactly.
I don't know about you, but I...
The shift in motivation is between what Maslow called deficiency needs and being needs.
Mm.
Deficiency needs feel like it feels like you're lacking something and you need to get it. And that's true of belongingness needs or safety needs or self-esteem needs. And so it's like hungry. You have to go out and get food.
You can go out and get what you need. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
The being needs operate very differently. They operate out of an abundance motivation that you're overflowing.
You can give away a lot then at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also then, certainly in competition, the competitive drive drops away. And it's much more as you were saying earlier, that, you know, love the opponent.
Well, in an existential level, that's really the most wonderful place to be when you're playing. Because
you're
beyond competition. You're just playing, you know.
Right.
It is so incredible, you know, and you're not even thinking about winning, losing. You're just playing. But in football, you know, it's interesting. There are points where you come up against, you know, if Ken Wilber is a running back and I'm a linebacker, I'm going to have to put the brick on you. You know what I mean? And of course, you're going to try to do that to me.
Yep.
So we are going to have a point of contact. But even in that point of contact, Ken, it's when, I mean, I've hit guys and guys have hit me and jumped up and went, holy moly, that was great.
Yeah.
You know? and because that's just part of that process, and you do it, and it's just part of the game, you know?
Right.
It's not anything that I'm trying to kill you. We just had a good hit.
Right.
You know?
And that does seem very much sort of in that existential moment and that moment of abundance motivation.
Mm-hmm.
You're not
mm-hmm.
taking something away.
Right.
You both basically contributed to something to that moment, and you're overflowing. It was just a great, great contact.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it, a very nice way to put it. Actually.
But we are facing then the general problem that the most common lower-left context for many of these sports, particularly team sports, continues to be winning, continues to be competition.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm even wondering if there's a way to handle that. I mean, in your experience with this and in the years since that you were actively playing, what was sort of one of the most common ways that guys would switch from winning to a self-actualization or an abundance drive or an integral drive or
I think it's a thing that happened individually with players, and when you tried to step out of it, in fact, it was one of the reasons why I got benched. It was not only my activities outside, but I gave an interview in the paper. We played Baltimore, and Baltimore had won. Actually, it was the year that they went to the Super Bowl, and Joe Namath's team beat them.
Wow, yeah.
And they beat us 20-0. We didn't have our strong safety. Jerry Stovall was hurt.
Yeah.
And John Mackey, who was my teammate at Syracuse, we were 17-year-old young pups when we went up there in 1959. And it was the first time I had played against Mackey in the league. And I was linebacker, so I played him head up.
Right.
And I had a great game against John.
Yeah.
And a little secret that happened, but I had a great game against him. And I gave an interview after the game was over, and I said, you know, I didn't know whether I should feel better having a great game and losing, or if we won and having an average game.
Yeah.
And I said, I thought, you know, I had a great game.
Yeah.
And in other words, implying I didn't really give a shit if we lost or won.
Right.
And boy, I tell you, that hit the locker room. I mean, hit the coaches. And yo, what are you talking about, Mega? See, you don't care about winning. And then, come on, I just was making a comment. So, So that notion, you know, I mean, it happens on a personal level with a lot of guys, but boy, I'll tell you, you move to the context of winning doesn't matter that much.
Right.
No, you don't. That's one of the verboten things you don't express, you know.
And
that's in some sense the context that you're up against. But on the other hand, I think the winning losing has to be part of it. It is part of what sport is.
Right.
You know, and you can't say, no, we're not going to worry about it. Yeah, you are going to worry about it.
Right.
Because I believe it is the driver that allows for these extraordinary
right.
events to happen on
right.
the individual level and even on the team level. I mean,
right.
if you ever see sometime a team will get rolling and then suddenly the other team will get rolling and, well, what the hell happened, you know?
Right.
And so it happens also on a context or on a team level as well as an individual level.
Yeah, and I wonder what it would take to get coaches to realize that when somebody made a statement like you did, that they're, in a sense, really coming from the zone. They're coming just
mm-hmm.
from the flow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually going to increase the likelihood that the team will win.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, an attitude of not winning will increase the likelihood of team winning.
Yeah, in a certain kind of way, it's true. Absolutely. Yeah, or not to even worry about it, just get out there and play. I mean, again,
yeah.
back to the Millman film, that was basically the message of that film was
right.
was just play.
Right.
You know. And I think it's probably true with you know, musicians, listening to your interview with, what's his name, Stone, the
yeah.
Pearl Jam. I mean,
right.
you know, and I think about those guys, and I mean, you know, when they're playing, I mean, they're not, you know, worried about anything other than just playing, you
right.
know. And that's when the best stuff comes out. I mean, I think in anything that people do, really.
Right. And I think you are right that the whole attitude of competition is largely, not entirely, but largely restricted to sport, but that is part of the driver that gets guys into non-dual causal and non-dual
yes.
states.
Yes. Well, it's what it takes. I mean, that's what
yeah.
I would say. You know, thank your opponent more than your teammate because
right.
he's the guy who got you there. You
right.
Because without him, you could never have engaged this experience to get there.
Right.
And, well, meditation is obviously different, but that's a whole different process.
Right.
Than the athletic one.
You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.